Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we remember Langston Hughes. Today, if we know Hughes, it's for one poem, A Dream Deferred, and for being among the first generation of African-American artists who asserted an art that comes out of being black in America. He was a leader of the Harlem Renaissance and an innovator and creator of jazz poetry. But the critics of his early career blasted his work, depicting the common black man in the nightlife of jazz and blues clubs and saloons and bars. Although he championed many younger black writers, as he aged, he was dismissed by many of them for being old-fashioned and tame. Among critics, the reaction changed from being too vulgar to being shallow. Yet his output of poems, essays, novels, and plays remain. Poems like I Too Sing America and The Negro Speaks of Rivers. His simple stories, a Harlemite's musing about the events of the day, or Kurt Vile's street scene, which he contributed to the lyrics. And his writings were an inspiration for others, from Lorraine Hansberry's A Raisin in the Sun to the rhetoric of Dr. Martin Luther King. Well, my guest today is the co-editor of the Letters of Langston Hughes. Hughes was a copious writer of letters, and this one-volume collection documents Hughes' entire work from his early years as a young aspiring writer to his work with the Harlem Renaissance to correspondence ranging from Zora Neale Hurston, James Baldwin, and Richard Wright to Martin Luther King, Muhammad Ali, and Alice Walker. Collections edited by Hughes' biographer, Arnold Rampersad, and my guest today, David Rozelle. Rozelle is the associate editor of this collection and also the co-editor of the collected poems of Tennessee Williams and Mr. Paradise and other one-act plays by Tennessee Williams. He joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. David Rozelle, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Rich. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Now, when you and Arnold Rampersad decided to put out this book of the letters of Langston Hughes, what was the driving force for a re-examination of Langston Hughes's work?
The letters have been in the Langston Hughes papers, and there's so many letters. This is just a selection. In some cases, we were only able to include one or two letters to a particular person when there was a whole folder of them. But I think that one of the interesting things is Langston Hughes wrote an autobiography. Two of them, in fact, and he looks back on his life, and the letters give you a chance to see somebody actually going through an experience. I'm not saying that it's more authentic than, say, what happens in an autobiography, but it gives us a different picture when we see the person responding to recent events, things that just happened to him. I also think that Langston Hughes's just a wonderful person, and the more we learn about him, the more we admire him. I've had the experience where you've read the letters of an author and they just don't seem as interesting or nice as you thought. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes they gossip about people and, you know, you see a side of them that's not attractive. And in Hughes' case, I think we see a really authentic, genuine, generous individual.
Today, when we think of Langston Hughes, I think most people think of him for one poem, A Dream Deferred. Do you hope that this collection of letters will offer a critical reappraisal? Because, you know, as you know, Knopf, in addition to publishing the letters, has also republished The Weary Blues. And I suppose in some critical circles, Langston Hughes was thought as a bit simplistic. And when you actually go back and read things from the 1920s, there's this wonderful rhythmic quality to the poetry that, you know, given what we've had in poetry and in music in the last 20, 30 years, it's just this wonderful foreshadowing of what he was doing in the 1920s.
Well, I think that there are other poems. I would sort of answer that in three ways. Mm-hmm. The first thing I would say is that in addition to A Dream Deferred, there's I Too Sing America, I Am the Darker Brother, there's mm-hmm. I've Known Rivers, Life for Me Ain't Been No Crystal Stair, The Boogie Woogie Rumble of A Dream Deferred. I think that A Raisin in the Sun, little phrases of Langston Hughes are in our consciousness.
Right.
I think it's hard to find another writer who has embedded so many nuggets and phrases into our everyday speech, even if we don't know they come from him. The other thing I would say is that Langston Hughes, poetry doesn't sell, so he was on the lecture circuit did poetry readings. Most of his life, he made his money by giving poetry readings around the country, at schools, at churches, and he realized he had to reach the people. I would say that most of his books were sold at such poetry readings. So he wasn't the sort of author who sits in his room and writes and sends a manuscript out to a publisher. There was a large interaction with the audience that he was most engaged with. That was the African-American common people. And so the poetry still speaks to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, and also that it can be used in schools. And I think he's proud of that, that he is there as the people's poet, not the poet of intellectuals.
And certainly that common touch comes through in so many of his poems. They're straightforward. They have this, as I was talking about, they have this great rhythmic sense to them. It's just they're a pleasure to read aloud.
In the 1920s, when he was using the blues themes and motifs and jazz in his poetry,
mm-hmm.
he was an aesthetic rebel at that time. This was not something that was accepted by the black establishment. There were terrible reviews of his work because this was not a side of the black community that they thought should be expressed in literature, that neither the white readers should see it, nor should black readers be encouraged to engage with. So he was an aesthetic rebel in the 1920s, and so I think that using those simple motifs for us now was revolutionary when he did it. And
yeah.
he believed that African-American music was central to the African-American experience, and that poetry, plays, and novels that expressed African-American life had to be rooted in some way in the African-American musical tradition.
We take that as a given today, but how out there was that, at say, in the 1920s, when he published something like The Weary Blues, or started writing poetry, or started writing stories?
The reviews are clear that when his mostly blues volume in 1927, his second volume, Fine Clothes to the Jew, came out, he was called a sewer dweller, you know, a purveyor of filth. You know, it was just because then the blues and jazz were considered lower class art forms, and so not something that a poet should be engaged with. And even other African-American poets took issue with Hughes for bringing that strand into his art.
Was the dominant African-American poetry strand something sort of grasping towards modernism?
There was, County Cullen, you know, was writing mm-hmm. in sonnets.
Mm-hmm.
There was a feeling that in order to show that African-American art had matured, it had to be able to use white forms.
Mm-hmm.
After W.E.B. Du Bois's Souls of Black Folk, there was a lot of use of spirituals, and so James Weldon Johnson's God's Trombones was very influential. But that was considered, you know, religious and sort of a higher form.
As opposed to nightclubs and blues clubs and dives
exactly.
and bars, yeah.
Yeah, so after W.E.B. Du Bois, I mean, the spirituals had this root in slavery, and there was sort of an empowerment story to them. Whereas for the blues, I mean, we see that now, but at the time, I think it was more considered just a low form associated with drinking, gambling, a form of life that shouldn't be celebrated.
Yeah. My guest today is David Rozelle, who is the co-editor of a new book from Knopf, The Selected Letters of Langston Hughes. Editors say that they could have done 30 volumes, given the volume of his letter writing, even though he professed not to be that much of a letter writer. He obviously was very prolific, and he saved everything he wrote, too, which was always a blessing for researchers. Langston Hughes was, he lived in this really remarkable period of time. You know, we have to remember he was born in the days of Plessy versus Ferguson. African Americans were definitely second class citizens. He came of age and was in middle age in a time when an African American could be lynched, and federal anti-lynching laws were held up in Congress. He came of age at the time of the Harlem Renaissance. He was in Paris in the 1920s, which we always think of African Americans having this incredible experience in Paris in the 1920s. It sounds like his experience was not so much. He's preaching about black pride, about the pride of his race at a time when that was not preached, and yet he's outstripped by events during his life. It's really a rather remarkable story that shows up in these letters.
Oh, yes. I think that in some respects, and I do believe that at heart, Langston Hughes was the poet of civil rights. It's fairly clear that Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream speech, borrowed phrases and motifs from Langston Hughes, who was talking about having a dream from the 1920s on. And I think one of the things that sort of separates Hughes from a lot of other authors is that he never, despite hardship and disappointments, he never despairs. He writes, "Hold fast to dreams," and throughout his life he did, and he really believed in, the dream gets deferred, and yet that dream resonates throughout his work, this dream of a society where all are equal, no matter the color of their skin or who they are or what they are. And it's that's the dream that Hughes had, and he wrote about it from the beginning of his career to the end. Now, he did, as many authors did in the 30s, find that socialism and communism seemed to offer a better way towards the dream than the Republican and Democratic Party. And but one has to remember that at the time that he, in the 30s, neither the Republican Party nor the Democratic Party were advocating the end of segregation, which was the most important thing to Langston Hughes.
Right.
So he had to find, how many parties could you have been in the United States that were saying, right, the most important thing we have to do now is end segregation. You can see why so many African Americans were gravitating towards the political groups that were saying what they were saying.
Of course, in 1953, he had to testify before the McCarthy Committee, in which he didn't name names. He was never a communist officially, but he did have to renounce his quote, radical past, unquote.
He did. That story is very interesting. The McCarthy's assistants, Shine and Cohn, established an agreement beforehand where Hughes would, in fact, renounce his past, but he would not have to name names. It seems as if he humiliated himself a little bit in Washington. On the other hand, it seems like he outfoxed the committee. In the testimony, one of the interesting things is Senator Dirksen at the very end asked Hughes whether he was treated well by the committee. And I think that the committee at that time was worried that it would appear that they were treating African Americans and other minorities badly. So there was an interest in having Hughes say no, as he did. No, I was well treated here.
Uh-huh.
So I think, but one of the things that I think was very important to him was that he would be able to continue his lecture tours and continue to reach his audience, which was the children in the schools. It's not just how he made his living, but it was a lifeline for his art. And there was a concern, which I think comes through in the letters, that might be broken.
Right.
If he were condemned by the committee and the churches no longer wanted him to come and talk.
For all of his output of poems, short stories, books, theatrical projects, even a movie or two, really he made his money from those speaking tours and going out and sort of selling his books in public, in person.
He had had one sort of success on Broadway, which was in Street Scene.
Yeah, Kurt Vile.
Where he worked with Kurt Vile and Elmer Rice, and that gave him enough money to buy the house in Harlem on 127th Street, where he lived most of his life from the late 40s on. But he was never wealthy, and there was always pressure. You see that in the letters where he feels compelled to sign contracts for books that he doesn't really want to do, but he needs the advance money. He calls himself repeatedly a literary sharecropper.
Yes.
You know, that, and so it is it was a struggle from the beginning of his life to the end of his life, and he never was able to, I don't think he wanted to, but he never, you know, moved to the nice side of town, you know, to Paris. You know, he never had the money to, live the sort of life, say, that James Baldwin lived.
What I found most fascinating was especially his early poems or his early letters in which he's, you know, trying to make his way in the world. He has a very difficult relationship with his father. He goes to Paris, and I was speaking of this earlier, you know, we think of Paris in the early 1920s as being sort of a place of liberation for black artists. It was for performing artists, but for an aspiring writer, an African-American writer, it was not a great place. And in fact, he found it to be less than welcoming. You know, he tried Columbia. I love his application letter for Lincoln University, where he eventually graduated from. You know, here he's about to have his first collection published by Knopf, and he's almost like hat in hand. I hope you'll accept me. And he lists all of his achievements. And, of course, the dean applied immediately. Yes, we would love to have you. But it's really quite interesting as he's finding his way in the world, because he documents that as well through letters.
I think that we can see the tension in the early letters with his father about money, about direction in life. And we can see why he has almost no contact with his father after 1922. As he says himself in one of the letters to Charlotte Mason, he saw three periods there, his life with his mother and his grandmother, what he calls the life of books, where he was very introverted as a child, and books were his world. And then he goes through the period of solitary wandering, where he supposedly throws his books into the sea on the way to Africa and, you know, just wants to experience real life. And then that third period in Lincoln, where he becomes part of a group. And one of the things I think that is important, differences between Zora Neale Hurston, who grew up in Florida in the famous Eatonville, an African-American community, and Langston Hughes, who really had to learn about the South by going there and had to learn about jazz later in life. And he writes at Lincoln, he got to be comfortable among his people. And then in 1931, he writes after his tour that he really got to know the South.
Right. And I found that amazing that he says, it was at Lincoln University that he finally learned to be comfortable around his own people. He'd gone to Columbia earlier and obviously wasn't comfortable in that situation either. He was a person who was really uncomfortable in either world of those sort of bifurcated world of America in that particular time.
But I think when we look at how he grew up, I mean, he grew up in a household with his grandmother, and she insisted on quiet, and he had to read. And I also, you know, so I think that it's not unusual for a young artist to be a little bit introverted and have to experience life in order to find out who you are. And I think in the 1920s, we see this young man finding out who he is, and in 1931, he comes to this momentous decision that he's going to be an author for the rest of his life. Mm-hmm. But we I think what's interesting in the letters from 1921 to 1931 is we see him. We can see him growing. We can see him taking these steps. We can see him progressing towards becoming what he was very proud of, an African-American writer who lived just by his writing.
And not only did he live by his writing, he also lived through these letters, which sort of is a who's who of the 20th century America. Everything from Carl Sandburg to Gwendolyn Brooks, Martin Luther King Jr., Amiri Baraka, Muhammad Ali, Ezra Pound, Richard Wright, Kurt Vile, they all show up in these letters, and it's really quite an amazing story of a man who lived this particular point in life and saw so many changes during that life. He went from a revolutionary to somewhat less than revolutionary as events of the 1960s took on, although it was kind of interesting. I expected him to be more of an elder statesman than it appeared from the letters. Is that because he died at 65?
He died at 65. And I mean, my view would be that it was very hard for Langston Hughes to become the elder statesman, because that implies that you're, have a position, you know, where you feel you can pontificate. And one of the things about Langston Hughes, I think, is whether it was religion or politics, he hated pontificators. And he didn't become one. I mean, I think that when we look at the elder Ralph Ellison, he seemed to have an opinion on everything.
Right.
And it was easy for us to know what it was. I don't think that you always see Langston Hughes as somebody who was going to go down to the neighborhood bar and sit there and talk with the people as an equal. And I don't think that he ever wanted to be anything but that. So I can't imagine him in the role of an elder statesman. I do think that he wanted to make sure that in the 50s and 60s that the positive picture of Harlem was offered as well as the negative. You know, that we see that in the letters where people will say, well, you didn't, you know, you're writing about Harlem and you didn't talk about this or that or this. And he'll say, well, you know, people are talking about that, and it's important for us not to forget that it's not just the bad things. It's not just what gets into the news. That there's a community here that works together and has a lot of human talent that needs to be recognized. And I think that Hughes consistently wanted, sometimes people feel he went too far in that direction. I think he would feel that he was balancing out what others were doing. It's a little odd because in his younger days, he was accused for exactly that, showing the bad side, the blues, the gambling, right? The negative. It's exactly what the critics accused him of in the 1920s, showing the negative side of black life. And when younger artists did that in the 60s, whereas he didn't criticize them, he did sort of point out that that's not the only way to tell the story.
Right. Well, what do you hope this volume of letters will do for Langston Hughes's reputation? Do you hope it'll get people to read more of his poetry? What exactly?
Well, certainly we want people to read his poetry. Letters tend to be popular.
Mainly because nobody writes them anymore.
Well, I won't say it will break my heart if the letters sell more than the collected poems, but in some ways it will, because I think that we have this fascination with individuals and the cult of personality, and yet what's important about Langston Hughes is what he wrote in his art and his poetry. I do think that the letters show some insight into how he became a poet. I think it's fascinating that the one of his more famous poems, you know, I Too Sing America, I Am the Darker Brother, was written in Genoa, Italy. And we wouldn't know that unless we had the letter in which he indicates that that's where he wrote it. But I also think that people are going to meet the person who wrote The Big C, the autobiography. So it's another way of learning about Langston Hughes, I hope it will make people read the poems and the stories and the novels that he wrote. I hope it sends people back to the autobiographies that he wrote. But I also think that the man himself is a very, very interesting subject and will remain an interesting subject for us for years to come.
David Rosell, thanks very much for your time. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rich, for taking your time too.
David Rosell is the co-editor of the Selected Letters of Langston Hughes. It's published by Knopf. Knopf has also decided to reissue Langston Hughes' first collection of poetry, The Weary Blues. And we're going to leave you today with Hughes reading the title poem.
Droning a drowsy syncopated tune, rocking back and forth to a mellow croon, I heard a Negro play. Down on Lenox Avenue the other night, by the pale, dull pallor of an old gas light, he did a lazy sway, he did a lazy sway, to the tune of those weary blues. With his ebony hands on each ivory key, he made that poor piano moan with melody, oh, blues. Swaying to and fro on his rickety stool, he played that sad, raggy tune like a musical fool, sweet blues, coming from a black man's soul. Oh, blues. In a deep song voice with a melancholy tone, I heard that Negro sing, that old piano moan. Ain't got nobody in all this world, ain't got nobody but myself. I was going to quit my frowning and put my troubles on the shelf. Thump, thump, thump went his foot on the floor. He played a few chords, then he sang some more. I got the weary blues and I can't be satisfied. Got the weary blues and can't be satisfied. I ain't happy no more, and I wish that I had died. Far into the night he crooned that tune. The stars went out and so did the moon. The singer stopped playing and went to bed while the weary blues echoed through his head. He slept like a rock or a man that's dead.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Taylor at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.